So, Nico, can you reiterate the last paragraph that you just iterated at me?
I'm reading from my Kindle, quoting James Altucher. I think that's his name. That's how it's pronounced. From the book Choose Yourself.
I, meaning James Altucher, was leading a retreat at a spiritual resort, quotation marks, a few months ago. I wanted to charge nothing and title it Creating Success from Within. Two things happened. The retreat center said, no, you have to charge. And then they said, you can't use the word success. Our audience doesn't like that. I thought this was funny. Spiritual people hate the word success, yet they are more willing to charge their audience an arm and a leg to achieve it. FYI, I'm pretty sure that's called a scam. Not that success-oriented people are any better. They hate the word spiritual just as much. It reminds them of New Age bullshit or their childhoods when they were forced into boring religious instruction by parents who needed the threat of eternal damnation in order to get their kids to clean their rooms.
Nice. I think that's a nice intro into today's topic. Business, lifestyle, and the philosophical implications of business whilst wearing shabby trousers or no trousers at all. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, hobos. Today we will be digging into spirituality and success. But before we go to that, I'm Chris Kirkland, and here is Nico Apple joining me today from.
I'm still in Den and Chris. And I would provocatively rephrase the title, the thing we're talking about, into why spiritual people hate the word success and business people hate spirituality.
We like a bit of provocation.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we get into that, we got a nice review on iTunes.
We do, and we like blowing our own trumpets, so I'm going to blow it loud right now and read out an excerpt. So it's from Freedom Podcasting in the US, titled Authentic Philosophy for Traveling Business Owners. This is the bit I like.
These guys are thought leaders in the community of global traveling, philosophically challenged business owners who only need a laptop to grow their business.
So it's official, Nico. We are thought leaders.
Awesome.
That's it. And what perfect episode to mention that we're thought leaders, where we talk about the fallacy of following other humans. Splendid.
It's really nice that we don't have to start calling ourselves thought leaders first. Like, it's a better way of marketing.
We've got our hobo disciples marketing for us.
Exactly. Thanks to Ian Robinson for the nice review. And if you guys fancy the podcast and you manage to click through all the things you have to do on iTunes to leave a review, we would really appreciate it.
Okay. Splendid. Listeners, ready for our conversation on why spiritual people hate the word success and business people hate hippies?
Exactly.
So I recently had a, I don't know if the word's epiphany, but let's not say epiphany or summary. It was a nice counterpoint on the whole idea of spirituality and religion and beliefs. And I'm going to announce it right now. It came to me that basically there's not this Boolean religion versus atheism going on. I think that's a fallacy or an incorrect frame that only exists because most people in the world have grown up with some kind of religious backgrounds. And that makes people think that there is this actual sort of, it's like it's something that you are or you aren't, like you're a vegetarian or you're not a vegetarian. I think it's actually much simpler than that, and it's really got nothing to do with religious or not. Basically, humans are susceptible to influence by other humans. Whether the script that you're being influenced by is some sort of God thing or spiritual thing or Buddha thing or atheism thing or science thing, it's basically you're just following some script. And so it's not about whether you're religious, you believe in a God, or you don't believe in a God, or whether you believe in something that's irrational or nonsense or whatever. Essentially, all that's really going on with any belief, any sort of thing that happens in your mind, is you're basically following a script. And the scripts are written by other humans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what it's about. So I just wanted to introduce this idea that we want to get away from this idea of whether it's a battle of atheists and scientists against spiritualities, Christians and hippies. I think that's not where the battlefield is playing out at all. It's simply humans just have this predisposition, desire, whatever, to influence one another and to get them kind of reading specific scripts.
A couple of things come to mind when you say that. In the beginning, you said, I had an epiphany. And I immediately thought about the semantics or the connotations of epiphany, because I was almost wanted to interrupt you and say, well, look, if you are a rational person, you might have an insight. If you call yourself intuitive, you might have something like intuitions, and epiphanies. And if you are very spiritual, you might have an enlightenment.
And so did my insight give you any kind of enlightenment, Nico?
Yeah, sure. First of all, it's funny that you use the word script, which is maybe even more close to your background as a programmer. I think in...
Or a movie writer.
Yeah, writer. Maybe that's also like in English language, that's a little closer. But as far as I remember, in models of psychology or psychotherapy, in transactional analysis, TA, I think they are talking a lot about scripts. And they say that people are running scripts in arguments, in relationships, and you basically just repeat certain scripts. It's not only a spiritual idea, it's also like a scientific, psychotherapeutic idea. Yeah, so I see those scripts. And I was also reminded when you talked about the different variations or the different packagings in which they come, different forms, you know, they could be religion, they could be atheism, they could be some form of spirituality or whatever. But when they come to you, and I remember like the first couple of scripts, like in the beginning, you're very happy to discover them. You know what I mean? They make so much sense. You know, you discover this model and whatever it is, it explains so many things and it answers so many questions. And the more you learn about it or the more you study it, the more you think, oh, this is great. This actually this solves a lot of the questions that I had.
As we both know, humans like simple explanations. You've got to grossly oversimplify.
Exactly.
Wyatt
Woodsmore.
Something small.
Yeah. And people don't like complexity. That's what he says. So you got to, everything has to be super simplified and then it becomes way more digestible and actionable, right? Yeah. I totally can follow the insight. So what are the consequences?
I think this serves as a piece in our jigsaw puzzle of the power of nonsense. Is firstly to abstract all of this nonsense. And I felt like this insight, it, as you're saying, it kind of creates this equality. It sort of levels the playing field across all the different scripts that are coming to you. Because as I said, we're kind of born into an unequal world where there are pre-existing scripts like Christianity. And because we've kind of grown up from such an early age with this notion that there's a God and things like this, we're like blinded by that script. We don't realize that it's just a script like the scientific script is, or the Buddhism script, or whatever else, you know, the internet marketing script.
Mm-hmm.
So firstly, I wanted to introduce this sort of framework for sort of understanding what's going on when you're presented with ideas, scripts, beliefs, however you want to call it. Try and create some sort of equality there, so you don't like give science more credence than you would any kind of hippie bullshit. you've got to look beneath the surface and think, well, what human is behind this trying to sell me a script? Is that, does that exist in this situation?
Mm-hmm. So now you said hippie bullshit and science. So is, can science also be science bullshit?
It totally can. If there's some sort of human behind it, that then it's, you know, how can you tell the difference? Having followed our friend Mr. Taleb a lot, I like the idea of looking for systems rather than like morals. So it's like if you've got a situation where the system creates something where people unconditionally believe other people, then you're just asking for trouble. Whereas if you create a system where there's always conditions attached, then you're not asking for trouble. Let me clarify that. If you give Mother Teresa ultimate power over everybody in the world, then it's much more dangerous than like having everybody being like Hitler, but just giving them no power at all. Mm-hmm. It's like the system, like humans are ultimately fallible and corruptible. Even the most saintly person in the worst circumstances is, you know, is likely to fail at some point. So I like the idea of, you know, looking more to systems rather than relying on trust and morals. So if we're talking about science versus hippie bullshit, you know, science has this kind of rigor and things to it. Anyone who's an internet marketer or a marketer will know that you can kind of focus on certain things and influence the way people perceive. So even with something as rigorous as science, it's still subject to the same human biases. As I was saying, you want to kind of look and see, is there some sort of human behind this that serves to gain from me agreeing and believing in the script?
Yes. There's a lot of interesting stuff here. So this human predisposition, obviously, and I think that's the value of the insight that you stated, the epiphany, is before you realize that there are all these maybe, let's call that maybe for now, maybe equal perspectives, there's this feeling and this need for superiority of your own kind of model, right? So people try to defend whatever they believe in, which is cause for a lot of not only arguments but also warfare or whatever. So before you realize that there might be valuable other models, equally valuable other models, there's this kind of like bias to think whatever you think is the best solution. Like if you are very scientific, for example, you say, well, you look, I'm super rational, I run experiments, this is not an opinion, that's a fact, and so on and so forth. And if you are hippie, you say like, oh, you're totally in your brain, you don't feel anything, you have no access to your intuition, you cannot tap into, you know, the oneness of everything and wisdom and so on and so forth. But you know, there's superiority is human predisposition. Once you have the epiphany, it levels the playing field, as you said. I hope I have already stated, and I will restate it, most of these things are models, right? And the value of a model is not whether it's true or false, but the value is whether it's useful or not. And useful means, like, by using the model, by following the model, do you achieve the outcome that you want to achieve? If so, the model is valuable because it's useful, but it doesn't prove that the model is true. You're following me so far?
Totally, yeah. So continuing on this idea of models, this is the next piece of the jigsaw puzzle. It's like, okay, we've got all these scripts, we've got all these models coming at us.
Yes.
Which ones can we use? Let's try some.
Yes,
and see which ones work.
According to the power of nonsense, that's why it's called the power of nonsense, we are not concerned with whether or not something is actually true, rational, and what else. But the interesting question is, does it provide you with any power, right? So we could use something that's totally nonsensical, maybe even proven false, as in not true, but you can still use it and it has some positive effect.
Do you remember the green lumber fallacy in Anti-Fragile?
Fairly.
Let me look it up, I mean, because this is precisely what you're talking about. Okay, here we go. In one of the rare non-charlatanic books on finance, descriptively called What I Learned Losing $1 Million, the protagonist makes a big discovery. He remarks that a fellow called Joe Siegel, the most active trader in the commodity called green lumber, actually thought it was a lumber painted green rather than freshly cut lumber, called green because it had not been dried. And he made a living, even a fortune, trading this stuff. Meanwhile, the narrator was into theories of what caused the prices of commodities to move and went bust. The fact is that predicting the order flow in lumber and the price dynamics narrative had little to do with these details. It's not the same thing. Floor traders are selected in the most non-narrative manner, just by evolution, in the sense that nice arguments don't make much difference. So I think basically the point is, the guy, he thought green lumber was lumber that was painted green. He had this sort of misconception as to what was going on. Mm-hmm. But whatever system he'd devised was working and was making a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is not completely the same as what you're talking about, but it's this idea that your beliefs don't have to be valid. They just have to be useful.
Yes. And you might even act on totally wrong and false assumptions, but if those assumptions might not have any direct impact on the outcome that you achieve.
Indeed.
So what we're saying is, you can be totally wrong in a lot of senses, but you could still be, let's say, successful, or you could still achieve the kind of outcome that you want to achieve.
I think it's smarter to just understand and assume that your model is totally wrong. And it doesn't matter as long as it's functional and it's producing the right result. So I don't think you don't need to get too hung up on where it's correct and where it's not. It's more like focusing on where it's functional rather than where it's correct. This is the human problem. We live in a very complex universe, which we don't understand and have little chance of fully understanding anyway. So rather than being too hung up on whether we're believing in the ultimate truth or not, it's probably going to serve us better to filter things by how useful they are and functional rather than how true they are.
Exactly. Now, you said something in your statement, you also said something about how some of these scripts are tied to a human and how there's somebody behind that.
Any sort of script or belief you have, is there a human behind it? Has somebody told you this? Is somebody else espousing these opinions and beliefs?
But you're not only mean like, is there a human behind it? Like, is it of human origin? Like, is the whole idea? You mean like, is there somebody who's going to benefit from you following that script?
Yeah, but it's basically both. If you can see that somebody's benefiting from you believing it, that's a very direct red flag, essentially.
Yes.
If someone else has told you the belief that you're believing, then that's also showing that a human's behind it.
All right.
Which, just to continue that point, I think that's the basis of any... the crux of the problem with any religious or spiritual belief, if it's coming directly, if you're hearing about it from another person, then you're not receiving a message from God, you're receiving a message from another person.
Yes. And I have told you about the philosopher / teacher Jiddu Krishnamurti.
Yeah.
There's this one text that you can find on the internet. I'm definitely going to find it and put it in the show notes, which is called The Dissolution Speech.
Ah, yes.
And that's like, it's just like, it's a very nice anecdote that totally makes the point. And I have not read this up on, I will also put the Wikipedia link in the show notes, but I have not read that and checked all the facts that I'm going to tell you now in detail before telling you this, but this is how I remember it. There was this guy, Rudolf Steiner, and a lot of other, you could say, intellectuals or whatever, and they had this group of people, which later developed to the so how was it called? The Society of, I don't know, it doesn't really matter. So let's say there's a bunch of people and they they were spiritually interested, and they obviously had enough time and money to think about that kind of stuff. And they somehow came up with the idea, it's going to come a new, what they call a world teacher, something like a messiah. Okay, so you already realize there's a lot of semi-religious terms flying around. So they thought there's going to come this world teacher who's going to tell everybody how to do shit. With aura reading and other very fancy spiritual stuff, they identified a young fella, Jiddu Krishnamurti, as far as I remember, together with his brother on a playground when he was still, like, I don't know, in his childhood. And they said, this could be the guy. And they put him and his brother in a school. Like, I think they took them out of India and they put him in a school in the UK. Like, they got lots of good education and so on and so forth. And they started this whole order, the Order of the Star, it was called, to help this coming world teacher to develop the skills that he would need. The whole order, like a whole bunch of people, were basically just the whole purpose was to help that development. And Krishnamurti was, I don't know, like very young, maybe something like 17 or 19 or whatever, when they tried to make him the leader of the Order of the Star.
Sort of custom designed a religion and groomed Krishnamurti to be the leader.
Yeah.
By giving all this background and training.
And now this is where basically, this is a little bit of the background, as far as I remember it, caveat. And then Krishnamurti basically is announced the new leader of the Order of the Star. And he has already spent a couple of years hanging out with these people, talking to these people. And now he gets basically up on stage and everybody says, so yeah, he's the new leader. And finally we have the world teacher has arrived and so on. And Krishnamurti says, first thing I want to do is dissolve the Order of the Star. This just makes no sense. You're trying to follow somebody else, which is me. That's the main fallacy here, because and everybody was obviously kind of surprised. And it's really funny. I'm not sure what the right terminology for that is, but if you kind of put so much work into something that turns out to be the one thing that destroys whatever you were working towards, it's got to be devastating in a way. But Krishnamurti, there's this dissolution speech where he very plain English explains, he says, if you think I can tell you what to do, you're never going to be free. You're never going to be independent. And you will always rely on me. And the other problem is, he says, we basically can't be friends. If you think I know and you don't, if you think I'm better than you and so on and so forth, it's never going to work. So he basically told everybody, you got to find out for yourself. And we can do this together, but don't expect me to be, you know, smarter than you are and so on and so forth.
So basically, this disillusioned speech is Krishnamurti pointing out that very thing I said about there being a human behind it. He was saying, I'm the human behind this, so it's not going to work.
It was one of the most powerful examples that I came across.
So as a sort of part two to this, maybe we should look at the spirituality and success
topic. Definitely. Why do the spiritual people hate money and success? And why do the business people have a hard time or hate spirituality and...
Let's look at them both, because I guess they're probably separate questions. I think the business and the spirituality is fairly simple, because it's generally the spiritual is in the realms of non-rational. If you're in the realms of business, you tend to be more vested in the world of rationality and of concrete things. Actually, I note that a lot of people, I know a lot of entrepreneurs do have a kind of spiritual side to them.
Yes.
And they do kind of have some sort of script, which isn't rational. So it's not as cut and dried as that. But I think the simple explanation is business not going well with the kind of spiritual stuff is because it's not rational, and it's very difficult to do your five-year projections based on things which aren't rational.
Yes. If you arrive at the point where you realize, even in business, plans will more often than not fail and you cannot control everything, it's not fully controllable by the mind.
Indeed. Let's not kid ourselves. The rational model is fallible. Nobody can predict which businesses are going to be successful. Shit is too complicated.
Yes.
And it might even need a dose of the power of nonsense. So anyway, let's look at the other side of the coin. Why is it that spiritual world doesn't like the word success?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. I may have also mentioned this already, but there's this idea of developmental psychology, I think. That's the word. Claire Graves is a name that comes up. I'm going to link to that in the show notes. He developed that model of basically how humans develop through certain psychological stages. And entrepreneurs is before spiritualism. And that it's a sequential model, so you have to go through the one to come to the other, even though a lot of people try to jump, which is not possible, according to the model. Following what Graves says, the entrepreneur and the business people are, in Graves' model, level 5. They are self-oriented. They are me before everybody else. The spiritual people are level 6, according to Graves' model. They are group-oriented. So they put humanity before themselves, or they try to, or whatever, you know, that kind of stuff. Also, the entrepreneur may not necessarily think that they need spirituality to succeed, but the spiritual people have the problem, that's why they may hate success and business and money. They have to do something to not necessarily make money, but
they're still going to pay the rent.
Right. From the perspective of a spiritually oriented person, and we're talking about stereotypes, obviously, I mean, like generalizations, they basically have the problem of making money. And from their perspective, it's more like it's a necessary evil to do business, which obviously for the, it might be a necessarily evil for the business people to have some spirituality.
Yeah. So to distill what you just said, I think there's this basic premise from the spiritual crowd that spirituality is about finding what's good and what's true and what's wholesome. And there's this kind of notion that that's what will fix everything. That's what people should pursue. And the world of money and business and capitalism is kind of perpendicular to that. It's creating differences in people's status and wealth and power and all these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of two models clash somewhat. From my own anecdotal experience, it's a little bit like burying your head in the sand. As I said, you've still got to pay the rent. I've tried practicing spiritual things myself, but I still had to pay the rent. Maybe I just did it wrong. But as you mentioned in the original quote, that you get the spiritual world, which still does have its roots very firmly ingrained in financial transactions. Mm-hmm. You'll have all kinds of gurus selling expensive courses on how to become enlightened. Meanwhile, they're doing this, they're sort of talking about these moral, spiritual goals. And on the other hand, they're just draining your bank account. I haven't found that many people. I guess, you know, you have people like Krishnamurti, maybe, but even Eckhart Tolle with his Power of Now, the guy's obviously making a lot of money from his books and from all his followers. You know, there's Eckhart Tolle TV, which you can subscribe to for, I don't know, $20 a month or whatever it is.
Yeah.
There's definitely a lot of commerce flowing through those veins. Anecdotally, I come across this again and again when I meet people who are sort of working in the spiritual world. You know, there's like this notion like, well, you know, it's about energy. I've got to kind of get energy back for the energy that I'm putting out. So I'm going to charge you $200 for this consultation.
Yes.
And so it's like, well, hang on a minute, you're still doing business.
Yes. They both run into some kind of dead end. If you're an entrepreneur and you focus on making money and the material things, borrowing a little bit from the Graves model, if you are in that mindset, let's call it, on that developmental stage, even when you have attained all the money and the material achievements, that's going to feel empty, what naturally follows from that. It's very dramatic, because if you're moving from one stage to the next, you have to basically, it kind of implodes, like whatever you have on that, you know, it falls to pieces. So the end of the entrepreneurial stage, best case scenario, you will have all the money, but you are going to realize that you still feel empty. And this is when you move to spirituality. And that's not the only thing that you move to, but that's like one part of it, okay? So you're going from the outer to the inner, you focus on the group, and that all that kind of stuff. Again, if you are in the spirit, in this so-called spiritual stage, there's also a natural end to that. I was reminded of the musician and artist Sting, very, very successful artist, made a lot of money with the police. Then, at the peak of their popularity, decided to leave the police. And there's this wonderful movie/documentary, Bring on the Night, where they show all the press conference and stuff, and Sting is leaving, and then he's creating this new band with his jazz musicians, and starts his own thing. And he becomes highly successful again. And he's famous for doing yoga, and his wife does it too. And I recently heard they have tantric sex and stuff like that. So, you know, the thing is, he can afford all that kind of stuff. Basically, he can be a full artist again because he has gone through the entrepreneurialism stage.
So what I wanted to do is tie this back to the success, spirituality and success. And I think what the Sting example is there's a correct order. You want to start with the financial success, the business success, before you go through the spiritual success. Because that's, according to this chap that you mentioned, that's the kind of stages you go through. Trying to kind of get the spiritual success first, you still end up with needing to pay the rent. And that needing to pay the rent can compromise your spiritual beliefs.
Exactly.
It's like you need the fuck you money first. You know, I wouldn't like to say, forget about your spiritual beliefs and just focus on making money. Sort that out later. I wouldn't say that at all. But it's like you've got to understand that if you still need to pay the rent, then that might have an effect on what you can do and think and believe.
Funnily enough, we had that kind of discussion with our friend John Bardos. You remember?
Indeed. Yes.
Where we had like really interesting and long discussions surrounding the how much do you need in order to be charitable and spiritual and more altruistically oriented, basically. Is there a certain sequence to it, which you just basically said there is? But there's a lot of other people that say, you got to learn to give, that's when you receive.
Yeah. And so on. So I think that one thing we're saying, to summarize, is there's perhaps a better order through which to negotiate things, and starting with paying the rent before focusing on the spiritual. But equally, we're not saying ignore the spiritual. The other thing I'd say is often having a finger in the spiritual pie, or should I just say the nonsense pie, can also be effective if it's giving you results. Mm-hmm. If you've got, remember the green lumber fallacy, if mm-hmm. you've maybe got a faulty model, but it's producing results. Like, let's say, for example, if things that happen to you, you kind of believe it's a message from the universe. If you play out that script in your unfolding of your business and it's working for you, then there we have a spiritual means to success in your business.
Yes. And we have to come back to that subject again. But I really want to emphasize, I more and more feel that if you succeed in fooling yourself in the right way, it's way better than not being fooled by anything, but not feeling whatever, good, motivated, or that you are.
It's better to have a faulty model that's got some results rather than no model at all and then no results.
And I would even go as far as to say through rituals and routines and selective perception and so on to basically rationally decide that in certain aspects it's okay to fool yourself because you feel better, and by feeling better because of these quote-unquote illusions, you're getting better results.
Remember the placebo effect.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. That's what we're talking about in The Power of Nonsense, like consciously applying the placebo effect to...
to your business.
Exactly.
So I think that's a good good innings there, good topic.
I have nothing more to add.
Marvelous.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Drop by hoboceo.com for the show notes. Subscribe to the podcast. If you have any questions, critiques, whatever, there's a lot of different ways to contact us through the website, email, voice message, and we're also on Twitter at HoboCEO. See you guys soon.
See you guys later.
Hiring, hovering, lunching, launching, morality, morons, pipe dreams, protons, hunting, leaping, jumping, kite surfing, landing pages, optimization, and superheroes.
Another amazing podcast magic production.